This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and we come to you today, July 30th, 2002. We're glad to be with all of you in the tri-state area of New York on WBAI. Ralph?
Maya, we're going to be discussing today, as we have over the past weeks, what we have called crony capitalism. But I think it's important to point out, we've attempted to do this over the many months, that in many respects, crony capitalism is an oxymoron. Capitalism, almost virtually by definition, requires the capture of the state and the use of its capacity to direct all resources and power into the hands of that handful of people who command the heights of the economy. That 2% that owns 90% of the national wealth, calculated by Robert Townsend in no more than 5,000 people who call the shots. And they capture the state to command power, but they capture the state as a coercive instrument as well. And when we talk about the CIA and the intelligence agencies and indeed the military arm of the state, that is a tool of capitalists, of the ruling oligarchy that commands power in this society. And they use the state to subsidize their operations. They get free land, free resources. They escape taxation. They deploy the entire infrastructure as an instrument for facilitating their profit. Talk about the corporate milk cow, the corporate welfare system. That is, by definition, the way the state is seen. Working people contribute multiples greater in taxation than they ever derive benefit from that state apparatus. On the contrary, the corporate ruling class contributes virtually nothing in the form of taxation and milks the society through its command of the state. And that translates as well into the uses of war. For war is not merely an instrument of state power for capturing imperial control over vast resources of the planet. We have 70% of the resources of the planet under the control of our corporate capitalist apparatus, and we have only 5% of the world's population. So less than 2% of 5%. Not only have 90% of the national wealth in this country, but command 70% of the world's natural resources. War is an instrument to further, to deepen, to secure, ever to increase profits. And that is what drives forward the capitalist state. And every time the cycle threatens capitalism, they prime that pump with arms production. And when they need to capitalize profits once again, based upon near slave labor and the capture of resources, they use war as a means to destroy. Marx laid that out in meticulous detail in Capital. War destroys infrastructure so it can be rebuilt again on a new basis of profit and cheap labor. Crony capitalism is an oxymoron, and every generation revisits this in the United States, no matter the nominal political party. Last week, Maya, we were off the air last week as we were discussing a particular relationship between Al Gore and Occidental Petroleum. And it's interesting to note, I think, in some more detail what that was really about, because it derives from a special report by Josie Ballinger, Nathaniel Heller, and Newt Royce, in Public Eye, about what Gore meant by reinventing government. If you recall, that was one of the slogans that was deployed by Clinton and Gore in their presidential campaign. They were going to reinvent government, which was a euphemism for cutting social services, for reducing employment in those aspects of the state, while increasing the state apparatus where it benefits capitalists. And in particular, in the case of the Naval Petroleum Reserve No. 1 near Bakersfield, California, a 47,000-acre oil field, it required taking that Naval Petroleum Reserve No. 1 and handing it over to Occidental Petroleum. They took the NPR-1, or what was known as the Elk Hills Oil Reserve, and they handed it over to Occidental Petroleum Corporation, the single largest privatization in the history of the United States, which gained immediately for Occidental Petroleum approximately $4 billion. Now, there are many aspects of this that we need to look at, and we'll do it briefly. By 1997, Elk Hills operators calculated that the value was almost $7 billion just for the field alone, and Occidental Petroleum paid $3 billion. They gained more than twice what its value was. And Occidental's reserve estimate of Elk Hills oil and natural gas reserves did not begin to tell the story of the value of this asset. So what were we dealing with here? Occidental Petroleum had long-standing links not only to Al Gore, but his father, the late Senator Al Gore Jr., Senior, was a director of Occidental Petroleum. And the then Secretary of Energy, Federico Pena, in 1998 wrote, Albert Gore Sr. on Occidental's board of directors constitutes a direct conflict of interest. The DOE, Department of Energy, has stonewalled all attempts by the Center Public Information to obtain under the Freedom of Information Act details about how this handover was accomplished. Now, why are we giving particular attention to this standard operational procedure which almost every administration, Democratic or Republican, has facilitated, namely the thieving of public property for the benefit of capitalists wearing a public hat? It's because it has a very specific history. This very field, NPR 1, was set aside in 1912 by President Taft as the emergency source of fuel for the U.S. Navy. Oil companies long coveted the field. It was the field involved in the paradigm of scandal in the 20th century, the Teapot Dome scandal of the 1920s, when the Harding administration's Department of Interior was bribed directly into giving secret drilling leases. And that scandal, which brought down the regime and was a touchstone of corruption, has in fact turned out to be the very field that the Clinton-Gore people handed over to Occidental Petroleum. And I should just mention, because I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, that between its 1976 production and its transfer to Occidental in 1998, the Treasury was gaining $17.1 billion. They were gaining profits for the government of 415%. There was accumulation of 1 billion barrels of oil. But that does not include, and nor did the price for which Occidental got this, 1 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, which is proven to be more lucrative than the oil, petroleum analysts say. And one last point about this, as Senator Dale Bumpers, the Democrat from Arkansas, pointed out when he said, I am not just shocked, but strongly opposed to this sale. The oil is a finite resource. We didn't get a fair value, and that was when the oil was $10 a barrel. It's a naval reserve, and now its value is at $33 a barrel. This is the way in which capitalism operates. It is the paradigm, and it is no less true of Democrats than Republicans, because it is one big property party with two names.
And last week, we detailed a company close to the Republican Party at this time, and that is Halliburton and its subsidiary, Brown and Root. As you will recall, our Vice President, Richard Cheney, had been the President and CEO of Halliburton for 5 years, from 1995 until he ran for Vice President with George W. Bush. And in December 2001, it had been announced that Brown and Root had secured a 10-year exclusive contract with the Pentagon for the Logistics Civil Augmentation Program, LOGCAP. Now, this is a cost-plus award fee, and it's indefinite, and it's for an indefinite quantity of building throughout the world, anywhere and at any time, to run the military operations of the Army bases at a profit, cost-plus. And today we'd like to go into a little bit more about Brown and Root and its relationship to both the Democratic and the Republican parties. Because Brown and Root became a world-renowned construction company through the offices of Lyndon Baines Johnson. And the military work of Halliburton through Brown and Root, the military work is almost 40% of Brown and Root's construction revenue, and it provides a very stable basis for the $13 to $15 billion of revenue that Halliburton brings in each year. So what do we have? In Rampart, December 1967, there was an important article.
Maya, I'm very glad you came upon this article, and it is indeed important, but it's Rampart's Magazine, for people who are not familiar with it.
Oh, yes, Rampart's Magazine.
Published in San Francisco, and a radical magazine of the day.
Right, no longer publishing. And this is December 1967, the height of the Vietnam War. There was an article by David Welch, Building Lyndon Johnson. And at that time, Brown and Root had a $1.6 billion base construction program in Vietnam. And what David Welch said was that it was, quote, no accident, and that it was no Horatio Alger story. It is the story of a politician and a business on the make together. Now, we went into last week a little bit about the relationship of Brown and Root and Lyndon Johnson, and it's instructive to look at it in greater detail because we have the people involved include Franklin Delano Roosevelt, John Connally, who was a Secretary of the Navy and became the governor of Texas and switched party allegiances, Democrat to Republican.
He was Kennedy's Secretary of the Navy and then became a Nixon supporter at a later point.
So we have Brown and Root, started by two brothers, George and Herman Brown. And they were a road company. They built highways in the backwaters of Texas. And according to Welch, quote, they reinvested their profits politically, making friends in city halls and courthouses all over central Texas and in the state capital at Austin. And what they started to do was build a dam. And it is this dam that Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was a congressional secretary to Richard Kleinberg at the time, who was the heir to the King Ranch fortune.
And by the way, Maya, one of the things that David Welch points out is that at the time of the Great Depression, what the Roosevelt regime was doing, as he calls it, they were handing out those big federal contracts. FDR was passing them out like juju bees. And as Welch documents, who was getting them? It was crony capitalists who were getting them.
And among those cronies were the Brown brothers. And a lot of it was negotiated by a man, Alvin J. Wirtz, who was both the lawyer for Brown and Root throughout its history of that period, and also, at that time, a general counsel for the Lower Colorado River Authority, and then became an official in the New Deal for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And along with the rise of Wirtz and his legal partner was, at that time and throughout his career, John Connally, as Ralph had mentioned, Secretary of the Navy, who had also been a campaign manager for Lyndon Baines Johnson, and later the governor of Texas at the time of the John F. Kennedy assassination.
Now, Maya Wirtz was not just a lawyer for Brown and Root, but Lurch was the point man for Richard Kleeberg, who is the heir to the King Ranch fortune.
Right.
And it's Kleeberg who was involved with his congressional secretary, Lyndon Johnson, who Wirtz then targeted for political promotion.
That's right. And in 1937, it was Wirtz who led the way for Lyndon Johnson to be elected to Congress, with the funding coming from the Brown brothers. Now, this led to...
By the way, Maya, just to, on that point, the campaign was managed by Ed Clark of the Austin law firm of Looney and Clark, which handled the business of George and Herman Brown in cooking the legislature, bribing them one by one.
So what we have for the Brown brothers is that they moved from being road contractors into being contractors of dams. It started out with the Marshall Ford, the Mansfield Dam project, thanks to Lyndon Baines Johnson getting Franklin Delano Roosevelt to approve the funding for that. And then it led to contracts for a chain of dams and power stations on the Texas Highland Lakes and along the Colorado and Pedernales, all within Lyndon Baines Johnson's district.
In 2 years, Maya, his first 2 years in Congress, Johnson channeled $70 million of federal money into these hands.
Now, remember, this is $70 million in the 1937-1940s.
You might as well be talking about $7 billion today.
And as a consequence, Wirtz himself came to represent Texas Rural Electric, which was a statewide association of the cooperatives. Now, all this New Deal pork barreling was just getting their feet wet, so to say, in the industrial giant class. Because in 1940, with the development of World War II, Brown and Root, through the good offices of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson, started to become one of the major defense contractors, not in terms of weaponry like Boeing, Northrop, Grumman, Lockheed, but in terms of building the infrastructure for the military throughout the world. And they got their first contract in 1940 to build a naval air station at Corpus Christi, Texas. And at the time, this was the biggest cost-plus contract ever awarded in the United States.
Not only that, but Brown and Root was handed 37.5% of the action, and the cost of the station was three times the original estimate and climbed to over $100 million.
During that war period, Brown and Root, just as Welsh says, quote, feasted at the Navy trough. But that was only the hors d'oeuvres, because then came the building of the bases in Guam in the 1940s and in Spain in the 1950s and later in Vietnam in the 60s. And as they started to build these bases for the United States, so too came the contacts with governments throughout the world, so that eventually at that time they were building in 37 countries up to now over 100 in 2002. And what we have in 1941, as the war was heating up in Europe, Brown started the Brown Shipbuilding Company, and he erected a shipyard along the Houston Ship Channel, built submarine chasers and destroyer escorts, 359 ships in all, employing 25,000 workers at the height of the war.
By the way, Maya, one of the features about the Brown and Root operations is that they were known to be union busting and they were union free. In fact, in Texas, a Brown and Root job means a job where you have no union protections and where you suffer a goon's harassment on a daily basis.
This has become the modus operandi of Brown and Root throughout the world, and we'll discuss some of their, quote, slave labor policies in Vietnam and forced labor policies in Vietnam, and later on in Kosovo, how they are, well, it's not slave labor, but it's almost slave labor because of the very low salaries that they pay with the full knowledge of the U.S. government.
Well, actually, it's the U.S. military, Maya, in Kosovo who police this thing, and it's virtually peonage labor. If any worker in these places, in Kosovo, in these plants, raises any kind of question, they're subject to military harassment and sometimes worse.
In terms of busting labor unions, there was also a court at the auspices of Brown and Root in Texas. Legislation was passed so that to make unionization very difficult. And in 1950, Brown and Root's lobbyists arranged for a court order that enjoined 92 unions from picketing any of the Brown and Root jobs. So this is the history of Brown and Root. Now, we move on throughout the war. And
Brian, just before you get to that, I think it's worth mentioning that one of the characteristics of the Brown and Root operations, when they were getting these sweetheart contracts, when they were overbidding, when their cost overruns were sometimes three and four times as much as they had bid, and they, of course, were paid these huge profits, there were kickbacks. And there was a big story about this in Drew Pearson's column in March 1956, and it had to do with the 1941 election when Brown and Root was kicking back thousands of dollars to Lyndon Johnson individually and to other politicians who were associated with the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt. They were called Brown and Root bonuses. And when the IRS attempted to investigate this, Alan Wirtz, who was Franklin Roosevelt's undersecretary of the Interior now, accompanied Congressman Johnson to the White House for a chat with FDR. That afternoon, Elmer E. Ray, the Treasury Department enforcement chief, phoned Dallas to say the president wanted a full report on the investigation. The next day, the file was deep sixed. End of investigation.
Not only was it deep six, years later, it was destroyed. They were destroyed in a fire. And all the tax returns for Brown and Root went up into the dust.
Tax returns and the individual bribes, which had now gone on for two decades, Lyndon Johnson being the principal beneficiary thereof.
This isn't the first of the investigations of Brown and Root that were swept under the table, much as we saw with President George W. Bush's so-called investigation by the SEC for insider trading, an investigation that had been headed up by none other than his former attorney on the Texas Ranger deal, and by a head of the SEC that had been appointed by his father and had been a general counsel. Now, when we go on with Brown and Root and the expansion of the Brown brothers, by the way, Root himself had been an early partner of the Brown brothers, and he died early on. They just maintained the name, so it seemed like a larger company than Brown and Brown. It was Brown and Root. Now, they went from shipbuilding to not enough to be in the defense industry. They went into the natural gas when, through again the offices of Lyndon Baines Johnson, they were able to buy the Big Inch and Little Big Inch pipelines of natural gas that had been built by the government during World War II so that there would be a supply of natural gas. And it went from Texas throughout the East Coast, and it Brown then controlled what was called the Texas Eastern Transmission Corporation, which today is owned by Duke Energy, the 14th largest corporation in the Fortune 500, one of the major transmitters of, it is the largest liquid natural gas company in the country and one of the major power companies. And that is the, and maintained, Texas Eastern Transmission Corporation was one of the Brown businesses outside of Brown and Root.
And so in essence, Maya, what you're pointing out here is a model of handing over government resources to companies, much like we've described here
with the Gore story.
With the Gore story, yeah. And by the way, you know, the Browns, as Welsh puts it very well, he says they were heavily dependent on Johnson for war contracts that made them rich. When peace was declared in 1945, someone turned down the valve on the government's bloody money pipeline. It became apparent that Lyndon Johnson in the Senate would be considerably more valuable than Lyndon Johnson in the House. They put him there. And as Welsh writes, war contracts depend for their very existence on a war policy. No one had better credentials as a war politician than Lyndon Johnson. From the beginning of his congressional year, he fought insistently for heavy increases in arms spending. In the late 30s, in the early 1940s, he was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's number one hawk.
And he was also a compatriot of Dwight Eisenhower, and especially in the promotion of the military-industrial complex.
By the late 40s, he was amongst the first to speak of the Russian menace and push for massive war appropriations. And as Welsh cites, his perennial concern for arms production was typified by the speech that Lyndon Johnson gave in Congress on March 15, 1948, on behalf of the Air Force and on behalf of Root and Brown and the rising Texas aircraft industry. And, of course, all these were going to be contracts for his buddy at Root and Brown. And here is what Johnson said. No matter what else we have of offensive or defensive weapons, without massive, superior air power, America is a bound and throttled giant, impotent and easy prey to any yellow dwarf with a pocket knife, unquote. A paradigm, if you like, of the inveterate racism which characterizes imperialist attitudes towards people they seek to exploit and to destroy.
Well, Brown and Root was able to make a lot of money out of such verbiage on the part of Lyndon Johnson, because the money followed the words. And in the 1950s, as the so-called Cold War was heating up throughout Europe and Korea, Brown and Root became the management contractor for the Air Force for the construction of 9 NATO bases in France. At that time, a $200 million plus contract, and as you will recall, all these contracts ended up costing at least 3 or 4 times what was originally allocated, and Brown and Root always got what they billed. So we have them then building the NATO contracts. Building bases and building ships with Brown Shipbuilding, and controlling natural gas through the Texas Eastern Transmission. And so what we have is, in 1962, when Herman Brown died, George Brown sold the company as a full subsidiary to Halliburton, which at the time was the world's leading oil and gas service company and still has that position today. And that put Brown and Root, with the close ties to the Pentagon, to Halliburton's close ties to the oil construction business. And it was Brown and Root that actually developed the first offshore oil rigging in the world.
And it's worth mentioning, Maya, that In 1953, as Brown and Root was consolidating its control over the Cold War massive armament contract, Senator Wayne Morse from Oregon made the following statement. Texas is a state with one senator from Standard Oil and the other from Brown and Root. I don't think you should confine it to Texas, Wayne Morse, but it was nonetheless evocative of what the real relationship is between capital, the Democratic and Republican parties, and the state apparatus.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. You can reach us at Veritas9, that's V-E-R-I-T-S 9, the number 9, Veritas9 at PacBell, P-A-C-B-E-L-L dot net, or write to us at Veritas Press, P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. And if you miss our address, please call the WBAI station and they'll give you our coordinates. We have available now tapes and CDs of our radio programs that have been going on since the end of December. So write to us for a catalog, an index, or contact us with the date of the program that you would like to have. As well, we have books and pamphlets available that we've discussed over some of our programs. Today we are talking about, in greater detail, the series we've been doing on crony capitalism, that is, the relationship of corporations and the state, particularly those corporations that have been connected to the President Bush's family and Dick Cheney, our current vice president. And as we have seen, Halliburton, for which Dick Cheney was the president and CEO and got over $30 million of remuneration when he left, and over $10 million during the years that he was the president and CEO, which was really not much money considering all the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that he has brought in terms of contracts both from the government and from the oil construction projects throughout the world that he has brought in for Halliburton as a result of his positions as Secretary of Defense for Bush Sr. and now Vice President for Bush Jr. for George W. Bush, our current president. And what we've been discussing is the relationship of Brown and Root, the fully owned subsidiary of Halliburton, through the Democratic Party and Lyndon Baines Johnson. And as Ralph was saying, Johnson as a senator was important for Brown and Root. But what would be Lyndon Baines Johnson as first vice president and then president of the United States?
By the way, Maya, in the biography of Johnson by Ronnie Duggar called The Politician, the Life and Times of Lyndon Johnson, he writes, Brown and Root got rich and Johnson got power and riches. Without Brown and Root's money, Johnson wouldn't have run, or rather been able to steal, the 1948 race for the United States Senate. That was the turning point. He wouldn't have been in the running without Brown and Root's money and airplanes. After the 1948 election allowed Lyndon to become president, he took off from there. Well, how did he become president of the United States? There lies a story, because we have, in essence, the story here of the execution of the Kennedy brothers, beginning with John Kennedy, in which not only Johnson but Brown and Root were deeply implicated and deeply involved. Because at the time of the Kennedy assassination, the Pentagon and the major contractors and the whole sector of that economy that was dependent upon massive U.S. military intervention was not satisfied with counter-revolution on the cheap. The Kennedy brothers were obsessed with Green Berets, with killer squads, with Phoenix programs. You know, they were particular admirers of James Bond. And they favored the reliance upon the use of ranger forces and assassination plans with indigenous forces to maintain the Imperium. But the Pentagon and its allies in Capitol had a very major agenda for a trillion-dollar war, which would escalate beyond Indochina. And it was around that dynamic that the Kennedy execution unfolds. I should mention, in relation to that, that Joan Mellon, the scholar who is completing a major book, 5 years in the writing, on the investigation of District Attorney Jim Garrison of New Orleans into the Kennedy assassination, called A Farewell to Justice, which will be published when, Maya?
November 22nd, 2003, the 40th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination.
And by the way, this book of Joan's, I believe her 17th, is the most, I believe, important contribution to the unfolding of the role of the Central Intelligence Agency and of the U.S. government in the assassination of Kennedy. It takes Jim Garrison's investigation far beyond where he was able to before his death. Joan sent us, and we're grateful to her for that, a series of Central Intelligence Agency documents which she was able to obtain amongst the many, many important documents that she's come upon and has researched and has analyzed for this important book. But this collection of Central Intelligence Agency documents is very apropos, because they identify as one of the principal operatives of the Central Intelligence Agency during this period none other than George Brown of Brown and Root. And one particular CIA document, number 104-101117-1023, specifies, and it even names the informant, the role of George Brown as a principal contact of the DDP, the Deputy Director of Plans, namely Richard Helms, who was the head of the covert operations that were not only unfolding in Vietnam, but entailed assassination programs of heads of state and of political opponents around the world. As Malcolm X said at the time of the Kennedy killing, you cannot have killer squads roaming the planet and think they're going to stop at your national frontiers. The chickens have come home to roost. Now, in this documentation that Joan has sent us, the Central Intelligence Agency documents disclose that the Brown and Root people were particularly apprehensive about the Jim Garrison investigation. And in one of the secret sensitive CIA documents dated the 27th of December, 1967, it's a communique in which it says that Barbara Frensley, President Barbart Frensley, President of Brown and Root, reported that Mr. George Brown has received a disturbing telephone call from Hugh Ainsworth of Newsweek magazine, one of the many journalistic assets of the agency. Ainsworth told Brown that he had received information from Bill Gervidge, an assistant to New Orleans District Attorney James Garrison, in other words, a plant in the Garrison office, that Garrison would be implicating Brown in the Kennedy assassination plot. The CIA document continues, Brown was involved in the CIA in its objective of covering up the conspiracy for President Johnson. Ainsworth said Servage had documents, including documents in Garrison's own handwriting, extracted from Garrison's files, in view of Brown's close cooperation with the agency. Brown asked Frensley to communicate this information to Haines. It was reported to headquarters. The relationship between Brown of Brown and Root, Herbert Frensley, the president, excuse me, not Barbara, but Herbert Frensley, the president of Brown and Root, and indeed of not just George Rufus Brown, the executive vice president of Brown and Root, but Herman Brown, the president and director of Brown & Root, becomes transparent. And we have as well a document that Joan has provided us from the CIA files, in which George Rufus Brown's CIA code number is disclosed, that of Herman Brown is disclosed, and a series of other such figures, such as Governor Alan Shivers of Texas, who was a signer of the statement that appeared in the New York Times, sponsored by the Central Intelligence Agency, for the Iron Curtain Campaign of International Rescue. And it was, by the way, Governor Shivers who asked the Texas legislature to make membership in the Communist Party a death penalty offense. The documents include a series of other agents and operatives of the Central Intelligence Agency associated with Brown & Root, and it includes a discussion of the role of the Brown Foundation, with a memorandum to the Deputy Director of Plans, Richard Helms. It is a trove of a demonstration of the real character of the corruption apparatus that major corporate capitalism entails, and its link to the coercive arm, to the Central Intelligence Agency, to its special operations, and as Jim Garrison was unfolding, to the Kennedy execution itself.
In talking about the Brown Foundation, the headquarters for the foundation were in Houston's San Jacinto building, and in the same building was a CIA favorite, the National Student Association and AFSCME, which did a lot of funding throughout the Arab world. It was American Friends of the Middle East, a CIA-supported group. And Brown & Root overtly made many contributions to AFSCME. And as I said, the offices were in the same building, of the downstairs from the offices of the Brown Foundation, and also it's the same building that housed George Brown's oil companies.
And you see, the over the many decades, the trillions of dollars of public funding that goes into these intelligence agencies is linked to major proprietorial corporate concerns such as Brown & Root, and central to the war game, the war industry, and the politicians, capitalists, the corporate capitalist bankers and politicians who hold state office, who bring it all together.
So
from Johnson to Cheney, from Franklin Roosevelt to Mortimer Snerd, George W. Bush, it's the same operation, it's the same crowd.
So when 1965, in August 65, when the escalation in Vietnam was taking hold, Brown and Root were major players. They were part of the consortium with Morrison Knudsen, which is another major worldwide construction company, in building the Da Nang, the Cameron Bay bases, also the major airport in Saigon, the streets of Saigon, the Long Binh Jail, and the helipad at the U.S. Embassy, $1 million at that time helipad. And that's only the tip of what they were doing in Vietnam. And at the time, who did they use for labor? The labor to do the construction, as well as there was a new port that they constructed. They constructed two harbor ports in Vietnam, major ports. The people they used for construction were the, quote, refugees, most of whom, according to Welsh, had been either forcibly removed from their homes in the National Liberation Front-controlled areas, and they were considered forced labor. As was reported by one Brown & Root supervisor, quote, they treated the workers as slaves.
Maya, they were being paid $35 a month. The mass of the labor force were making as little as $21 a month, 8 cents an hour, for a 60-hour week. American workers were earning on an average nearly 60 times the wage of Vietnamese laborers. Brown en route was engaged, as you say, and as you've emphasized correctly, in virtual slave labor, a function of the war machine, a function of the slaughter apparatus of which Brown en route was central in suffering Vietnam.
And the same happened in Somalia when Brown en route was called in to build the military bases in 1992, the U.S. Army bases in Somalia, where Brown en route was paid $62 million to build the bases. And Brown en route was the largest employer in Somalia. And when there was labor dissent, they used the United Nations to crush it. And as we reported last week about Camp Bonsteel in Kosovo, which is protecting the U.S.-sponsored Trans-Balkan oil pipeline and is one of many bases that Brown en route is building along this pipeline, Brown en route is the largest employer in Kosovo, hiring more than 5,000 Kosovo Albanians, and also has another 15,000 employees working at Camp Bonsteel. And what's important to note is that the staff at Camp Bonsteel rarely venture outside the camp compound. Their activities are secret, and the Kosovo workers are paid between $1 and $3 an hour.
And by the way,
the downsizing of the U.S. military has meant the shifting of work that normally U.S. soldiers would have done, along with their receiving pensions and benefits and a salary, and also having some form of health and safety regulations. It has been shifted to companies such as Brown en route, non-union, and hiring essentially slave labor, a very menial penury wages to the local populations, and they are doing the same in Afghanistan.
I should point out, Maya, that as we described in our small book, Death and Devastation in the Balkans, An Anatomy of Capitalist Rule, one of the linchpins of this operation in Kosovo was the alliance between the elements of the KLA and the Central Intelligence Agency and Brown en route in managing the drug traffic throughout Kosovo. It was, in fact, a main conduit for heroin, and there's an entire documentation of this, which is in this booklet of ours, and we'll go into this in another program. But I'd like to just quote the postscript to this very important article, Building Lyndon Johnson, that you I'm really grateful to you for coming upon this, the Ramparts piece in December 1967. David Welsh states the following. The story of the Brown en route Johnson team is a case study of big business control over American political life. Their connivance over more than 30 years may be more blatant, but it is not exceptional, it is representative. When Senator Johnson introduced a joint resolution on acceleration of military construction in 1958, he was joined as co-sponsors by 64 other senators, each with a vested interest in the flow of tax dollars to war contractors in their states in whom they had a financial investment themselves. The resolution stated, it is hereby declared to be the sense of this Congress that all such military construction programs should be accelerated to the greatest practicable extent. The main objectives are to reduce unemployment and put our productive facilities to fuller use, unquote, which in translation means, Welsh writes, a government subsidy to the giants of the defense industry and near slave wages. A large military-industrial complex dominates Congress, said Senator Fulbright last October. All we in the Senate are trying to do is to put some kind of limit on the power of the military-industrial complex to control the foreign policy of this nation, brothers and sisters.
Oh, those are words, really. After all, it is the Senate that recently gave President Bush the massive increase of funding, unheard of. Even the Wall Street Journal was in shock at the amount of money that was handed over to the military-industrial complex.
And this massive escalation of military outlay that became the basis for the war in Vietnam, the devastation of Vietnam, the nearly 5 million people killed and maimed in Vietnam, the permanent destruction of the ecology of Vietnam, from which the Vietnamese people continue to suffer today from weapons, biological and chemical. All of this was engineered under the pretext of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, a fabricated event. There has never been a capitalist war in the history of the United States for which there wasn't a lying pretext, a contrivance of government origin, no less in Vietnam than on September 11th. No less were the American people being terrorized in the Johnson escalation of the war in Vietnam than they are today with the preparations for martial law.
On June 5, 2001, U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld visited Camp Bondsteel, and he put it quite succinctly. He said to the armed forces, who are becoming a permanent force in the Balkans, not a temporary force, but a permanent force as they guard the future AMBO, the Albania-Macedonia-Bulgaria oil, the Trans-Balkan pipeline. He said, quote, "You're not a burden on the economy. You are the critical foundation for growth." And we have there at Camp Bondsteel the connection between the private industry building the camp and actually running the camp as, you could say, auxiliary U.S. troops. You have the U.S. military itself. You have the armaments industry of Lockheed, Northrop, Grumman, so forth. And you have the oil companies. For ExxonMobil and Chevron are anticipated to fund the Trans-Balkan pipeline, just one of the many pipelines that are intended for the Caspian oil reserves. Now, if you want to read more about the log cap and the privatization, the soldiers of fortune, as it's called by Pratap Chatterjee in his excellent series of articles, you can see some of them on Corp Watch's, CORPWATCH's website, or you can go to the San Francisco Bay Guardian, May 1st, 2002, at www.sfbg.com to read more about it.
I have to,
now, I have to mention my... we're almost out of time, so I want to mention, before you do that, that we are going to talk about other funding that we had wanted to get into, which is also explosive material,
yes,
about the relationship of Halliburton and Dick Cheney to Ex-Im Bank. That's the government loan and guarantees and also actual funding in the oil industry sector of Halliburton.
And as it, as you were saying, Maya, I'm glad you raised that, because Ex-Im Bank and OPIC are the government-subsidized vehicles for funding vast operations. And in the Cheney instance that you're mentioning, Halliburton was involved not just with the Russian capturing Russian oil fields, but with the Russian mafia and with the drug dealing of the Russian mafia directly, and we're going to detail that. But before, I just, Maya, when you were mentioning Rumsfeld, I couldn't help but think of the role that Republican Congressman Donald Rumsfeld of Illinois played at the time that Brown and Root was associated with Johnson. At that time, Rumsfeld of Illinois said in the Congress, "The continued revelation of so-called coincidences which attract the most unlikely business and political bedfellows to the privacy and intimacy of the president's club would suggest to all of the most innocent mind that that is where the action is." And then he later said, Rumsfeld, Congressman Donald Rumsfeld, this is in 1966, "The capacity of the Brown and Root bucket is certainly vast even by Texas standards, and it may prove to be bottomless as well, unquote. You see, at that time, brothers and sisters, Brown and Root was benefiting Lyndon Johnson, the Democratic Party, and the Rumsfelds of this world wanted their cut. Enter Dick Cheney, enter Halliburton, enter Rumsfeld in Mortimer Snurb's cabinet, and you see the relationship between the two parties and corporate capital.
Because it is under Donald Rumsfeld's watch that Brown and Root, Halliburton, have been awarded this open-ended 10-year contract worth billions and billions of dollars to build the U.S. military bases throughout the world. You have been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Again, you can reach us at veritas9@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week,
when we will again discuss the role of that permanent kleptocracy, the American ruling class.